Hi there, and welcome to My Cape York Life. Stories from the people who live on and care for Cape York Peninsula.
As a child in Cooktown, if we went to Cairns, it was probably once a year, and you'd leave at daylight and didn't get to Cairns until that night.
And then you drive down into this little pocket of rainforest.
Rainforest on sand, yes.
Yeah. Wodja Wodja so nice, you got to say it twice.
There's amazing sandstone cliffs. And
caves with bats, and yeah, it's stunning.
Fresh water seeping out of the walls.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely stunning.
Yeah, and not a person to be seen.
No, it was beautiful.
So that idea that you had of coming up to the Cape and you're going to make your fortune in cattle.
45 years later and nearly there.
I'm Lyndall Scobel from Cape York Natural Resource Management. As I get around the Cape, I'm amazed and inspired by people finding innovative ways to meet the challenges of living here. Like growing food. There's plenty of water during the wet season, but it can be hard to come by during a long, hot, dry season. Varying soil quality, pests, weeds. Growing food here can be difficult, so you'd think that expensive chemicals and supplements are essential. Not so, says Dr. Wendy Seabrook. Wendy lives on Hilltop Farm near Cooktown, where she's proved you can get nature to do much of the work for you and reduce your costs and your environmental impact. This isn't just for food producers. Wendy says it works for homes, businesses, and communities too. Sustainability, she says, is not an added burden. It's actually a bonus. Wendy Seabrook is an ecologist, and she's come a long way from her birthplace in the UK with all sorts of adventures and a PhD in cane toads along the way. We're having a cup of tea at Wendy's kitchen table on a typical wet season morning. I think you'll find her inspiring and thought-provoking.
My name's Wendy Seabrook. We're at Hilltop Farm and it's just about 20 minutes outside Cooktown on the Endeavour Valley. And I have a farm. It's about 24 acres of nice red chesnozome soil.
It's the wet season, Wendy, and it's a January morning, and we've got a light drizzle of rain. We've had a bit of a look at the radar, and there's some more rain coming. So it's quite lovely outside today, isn't it?
It's gorgeous, actually. Before you came, I was out spreading seeds, sort of forage sorghum and cowpeas and some stilo as well. So, look, Hilltop Farm I've been here for nearly 10 years. And it's really been my opportunity to sort of put all the wisdom and experience that I've accumulated over the years into practice, and to learn also from getting my hands dirty and getting and starting digging and learning from that experience in itself. And so Hilltop Farm is, you could say it's an organic farm, but it's more sort of more based on agroecology or ecological agriculture. And it's really been an opportunity for me to sort of take my knowledge as an ecologist into food growing.
So tell us about that. We can pick up a bit of an accent there. So where are you from originally? Where did you used to live, and what brought you? What was your journey in getting to this place?
I grew up in the northern suburbs of London, but I got the forms to come to Australia when I was 16 years old. So I always wanted to come to Australia. And sort of, but basically I studied ecology at uni in central London of all places. And I remember the first bit of field work we did was at Hyde Park on the Serpentine, which is a big lake in there. And we were doing plankton samples. And I remember at that stage it was a bit of a shock, because I realized that it wasn't just going to be all about sort of animals and plants. It was going to be about statistics and quantitative methods, and it sort of freaked me out a little bit. And then I looked at some of the graphs and tables in the textbooks and things, and so that was a sort of big transition. So I grew up in London, but never was at home in London.
So what was the attraction to Australia?
I think the space, the environment, and to be honest, when I was travelling around London, the Australians always seem to be so much more cheerful than the English, and so much more alive. Sorry if there's any English people listening, but just so much more alive and having sort of more fun. And I think the sort of space, And growing up in London, we used to go on holidays to the Mediterranean to get the sun, because my dad would get 2 weeks off. He had a butcher's business. And that was the only way that we could be sure that we were going to have the sun for 2 weeks. And I always thought, why do we come back?
So you did your university in London. You graduated as an ecologist.
So, yeah, I did my degree in London. And then it was so difficult to get any work at that time. So my grandmother had left me some money. And so I applied and did a master's degree in ecology as well in Scotland at Aberdeen Uni. And that was probably such a fun year. There were only six of us, and we did field trips. We went up to the Orkney Islands. We spent Christmas on the Isle of Rum off the west coast of Scotland, and we just sort of saw some beautiful locations and Neolithic sites, and learned a lot of the sort of stuff that I'd learned during my degree became sort of more consolidated at that stage. And then I sort of applied for various jobs, and I ended up on an island in the Indian Ocean for 2 years. It's an island called Aldabra, and Aldabra, I'm told in Arabic, means green clouds, and that's how the old Arab sailors used to find it, by looking at the clouds and seeing the slight green tinge in the reflection. So it was a raised coral atoll and 100,000 giant tortoises on it, just like on Galapagos, but a hell of a lot more giant tortoises.
Wow.
So, yeah, I used to have my afternoon siesta under the same tree as they did.
And what did you do there?
So I was employed by the Seychelles Islands Foundation and World Wildlife Fund as the conservation officer. So doing practical work, but it was also partly a sort of political decision too. It had been a Royal Society research station as part of the British Indian Ocean Territories. And I think that they sort of wanted just somebody to sort of keep an eye on sort of what was happening there. So I did a lot of work on feral cats and on green turtles. And I published two papers from that on, one was on, just, feral cat predation on green turtles. Basically, that was one of their main things that they would eat. And you imagine those little turtle hatchlings, they've got an egg sac in them, so they'd be highly nutritious.
I guess that's, we'll might bring that in a little bit later in the story, but that's a really interesting piece of research for somewhere like Cape York, where feral cats are becoming a much bigger problem. At the moment, they're not really one of the predators that we think about for turtles and for hatchlings.
Yes, I don't know what happens on here, but I imagine on Aldabra it was probably also sort of a feature of what alternative food sources they were, because it was just a scrubby atoll. There were beautiful seabirds on it. So I was there for 2 years, and then I came back and I got some work on another island off the west coast of Scotland, working on a bird called a corncrake. And in that meantime, I thought, I really still want to go to Australia. And so I applied to do my PhD over here. And that's how I came to Australia. So I came to Sydney Uni and did my PhD on cane toads.
Oh, wow.
So I have one of the few PhDs that people can actually understand, and usually, you know, it's sort of not too technical.
So what did you find? Tell me about that. Tell me about the PhD and what you were specifically looking at.
After my work on Aldabra, which was looking at feral cats, I was really interested in what impacts introduced species have and methods of controlling them. And so what I was particularly looking at is the habitats that they were using. What sort of vegetation types were they mainly hanging out in? And to see if we could use those as sort of methods of control. And one of the fun things that I did was I organized an evening, and I think we had like 80 people all out on one night looking for cane toads.
Whereabouts?
This was in northern New South Wales, and I did a smaller version of it near sort of Yungaburra area. And the reason is because everybody knows you go out on a nice wet night and you'll see cane toads everywhere. But if you go out on another night and it's drier, you won't see so many. So what I had to do in my research is, when I was looking at different vegetation types, you know, whether it's paper rainforest or paper bark swamp or, you know, equivalent up here, savanna woodland or whatever, you have to sort of say, be able to pick up how many cane toads you're seeing is different because of the vegetation rather than just because of the weather conditions.
Mm.
So, yeah, so I got about 80 different people, and we had four survey areas in each of the vegetation types. And they went out with there was a leader in each group, and they went out with their flashlights. And they all surveyed this huge, it was marked off the area, this huge area, and counted the number of cane toads. And what came out was really interesting and was really supporting my observations is that where there's dense canopy and or dense, well, sorry, there isn't usually dense ground vegetation where there's dense canopy, there's very few cane toads. So basically they're animals of sort of disturbed open ground and open canopy. And you can relate it to their physiology, sorry, I can't pronounce the word, because they can't see very well and because they're not very agile. So the clearer the ground, the better they are at moving, and the more open the canopy, the better they can see.
So the North Australia savannah country is perfect.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, where you have, you know, like say on the Laura River, where you have those pools, those remnant pools in the sand beds, they're ideal. So where there's dense vegetation around, if you've got a farm dam, for example, and you don't want cane toads breeding there, then the best thing to do is to create a dense margin of vegetation. So like if you've got a golf course and you've got a dam in it, or you've got a park and you've got a pond in it, and you mow right to the edges, that is cane toad heaven.
Mm. So you finished a PhD. You were still living in Sydney then, or were you based in northern New South Wales then?
I was based in northern New South Wales, which of course was much pleasanter than being based in Sydney. So, but I also did, as I say, did some work up at Yungaburra through the Yungaburra School for Field Studies, which brings in American students. They helped me with some surveys. Yeah, and then I did sort of odd sort of bit work. I did some event management. I did some teaching with TAFE. I decided that I really didn't want to be in academia. Basically, I saw too many people getting quite sick and from just the pressure of being in that situation, and I also didn't want to live in a city. And then, like a lot of people, I just ended up in Cooktown.
You just ended up in Cooktown. So how do you just end up in Cooktown?
Well, I was supposed to be sailing around the coast of Cape York, and that sort of fell through, and so I had some time to spare, so I started doing some work with Nature's Powerhouse in Cooktown. Cut a long story short, I don't know what came first, you know, in terms of chicken or egg, but I decided to stay in Cooktown, and then the job came up with the Land Care Program.
A lot of people will have heard of Cooktown, obviously, because it's where the captain stopped off on his way for some time. But can you tell us, sort of situate Cooktown on the map for people who may not have been here and may not understand how far away it is from a major centre?
Yeah, so Cooktown's 4 hours' drive. We now have a bitumen road. I think that came in about 5 years ago from Cairns. You know, I was speaking earlier about working a lot on islands, offshore islands. Well, part of the reason why I'm in Cooktown is because Cooktown's almost like an island. You forget it when you're here, but to go anywhere else, you've got a long drive. So we're pretty, as a group of people, we're pretty resilient. We can make do with things. And I mean, it's easier now, but you know, there wasn't the sort of diversity of building materials and food, and so a lot of people used to grow a lot more of their own food in the past. So yeah, and it's a very diverse place. You know, there's lots of artistic people, there's a few people who do fishing, farming. There's very mixture of people there, and of course, you know, a great indigenous population as well. And one of the lovely things about Cooktown is the way that we're sort of increasingly working together, which I love too. And the landscapes, you know, people come up to Cooktown on their way to Cape York, or they come up to Cooktown because it's a bit of place to come and visit, and they might do an overnight stay. I mean, I know because I have a farm stay accommodation. And then they come up here and they realise, oh, I wish we'd stayed longer. You know, the landscapes are so beautiful and the history is so interesting.
And the landscape here is really diverse, isn't it? It's a place where you've got different landscapes meeting up.
Yeah, I mean, you've got the wet tropics just south at Cooktown. You've got beautiful waterfalls. You've got, from here, looking out from the window here, we've got sandstone escarpments and rainforest in the gullies. And then you look north from Cooktown, and I think this is probably one of the key reasons why I stayed in Cooktown as well, is these beautiful headlands. And all in indigenous country.
So, Wendy, you were telling us that you found yourself in Cooktown, as many people do, and then a job came up.
Yeah, with the land care program. It was, in fact, there wasn't a land care program at that stage. So, I became the land care coordinator. I actually preferred the term land care facilitator, because I saw my role as facilitating, is helping people. It was through Cookshar and the Peninsula Pastorates Land Care Committee.
And what did you see yourself doing in that role? So that was for the whole of the Shire, or all of Cape York?
That was all of Cape York. And just so people can understand the scale, that's the same size as the state of Victoria. Mm. So a huge area. I mean, obviously not the population density, but sort of logistical, you would know this too, Lyndall, huge logistical issues, you know, sort of like people's front drives being 57 kilometres long and four-wheel drive the whole way. And when I first started out, I didn't have a satellite phone or anything, so I'd sort of arranged to drive out from a station and then call them from a roadhouse just to say that I had got out okay, because otherwise maybe somebody wouldn't come by for another 2 weeks. And of course in the dry season that's always a bit of a concern with sort of water and things like that. So
we're quite lucky on the well, I suppose for somebody like me who's travelling now fairly regularly on the Cape, and that main road up there, the PDR, has got quite a bit of bitumen on it. But when you were doing the land care facilitative role, I imagine there would have been very little bits of bitumen, if any. And the road can get in quite a state, not easy on your car, and not easy travelling, but it's incredibly scenic, and it's quite a absorbing drive, isn't it?
Yeah, especially if you're good at sort of looking at the details. I mean, some of it can be there, you look at the road and it just disappears into the future, up and out, sorry, not into the future, into the
horizon,
up and down, up and down. But if you look at it, the vegetation, it changes. You know, you've got different trees and things in the hollows or in the lower ground, and different trees on the ridges and on the creek lines, So
when was it? What year was it when you arrived in Cooktown? Do you think?
2000. I think it was 2004, 2005, and then I was involved with the land care program for about 5-6 years. And when we first started off, it was, there was an amazing amount of funding, and it was actually too much work for one person to manage. We had money for community capacity building, and I'm saying that sort of because, you know, that's sort of, it's an interesting one, because usually it's sort of spent on how to write grant applications or set up governance with not-for-profit groups and things like that. And
how would something like that be different in a place like Cape York than it would be in Sydney? I imagine it would be quite easy to organise a workshop around something like grant writing and have half a dozen groups get there for a half-a-day workshop and then they just go home at the end of the day. It's a little bit different on the Cape when you're organising things like that.
Yeah, distance is a real issue. And I think it's actually really good for somebody who's in a land care position role, because it really forces you to look at your marketing and to look at what you're offering the primary producers on Cape York, because it has to be something of value for them. And that's why I didn't do workshops on grant writing. We actually got the Department of Primary Industry, Queensland Government Department of Primary Industry at that time, had a Building Rural Leaders program, and we got that running up in Cooktown. And we got, would have been nice to have had more, but we got some of the property owners on the peninsula to do that 9-month course. And then we did some shorter courses up at Weeper and up at the top end as well, so we could actually do some leadership. So this is community leadership on the basis that we're all leaders at different times.
Wendy Seabrook at Hilltop Farm in the Endeavour Valley near Cooktown, Cape York Peninsula. and you can have a look at the place online. There's a beautiful drone video at her website, learningfromnature.com.au.
This is My Cape York Life, available from capeyorknrm.com.au. Look for Land Manager and Podcasts.
We're having a chat with ecologist, strategic thinker and farmer Wendy Seabrook at Hilltop Farm in the southeast of Cape York. Wendy had been working in the land care program, but the land that would become Hilltop Farm had caught her eye and her imagination.
It took a bit of time to sort of between sort of recognising that I wanted this land and actually sort of being in the sort of, it was being subdivided, so actually getting it there. But I've really had head down, bum up on my farm for 8 years. And
how did you know this is what you wanted to do?
Good question. I think that I really was, in a way, underneath it all, getting frustrated by not being able to really follow what my heart was saying. And so often when we're in positions, in government positions or positions that are funded by government organisations, is that, and this is my opinion, is that we're not really sort of cutting to the chase, we're not really going to the heart of the problem. And that's where we create the real solutions, the real lasting solutions. And, you know, and I'd had a lifetime of putting in my expertise as an ecologist into practice in different fields. And what I was seeing and reading about, especially from all places all over the world, were landowners who were looking at ways to bring more ecological functions into their food growing systems, into their farming systems, and gaining from them. The easiest way to think about it is if you go for a walk in a natural area, let's say you've gone into a forest in your local area, take a look at how productive it is. And also how resilient it is, how, you know, we've had several cyclones, for example, and how well the bush bounces back. Obviously, there's a point where it's of no return, but it bounces back. But it's productive, and nobody's, if it's not damaged too much, nobody's managing it. It's managing itself. And, of course, it's sustainable. It's environmentally sustainable. So as an ecologist, I thought, well, what is it? What is it about natural systems that make them productive, resilient, sustainable, and low maintenance or self-maintaining? And so it's been a sort of parallel journey for me, developing the farm and also developing what I call it, like a toolkit of ecological practices that I've developed to help food growers to bring those ecological, the way that natural systems work, into their food growing areas. So let's just have some practical examples. I mean, one of the things that we know is that now is that we can develop pest resistant landscapes by creating habitat for beneficial insects and birds within our production areas. And it may be with our ground cover. Now, for example, like macadamia plantations in northern New South Wales and some of the orchards areas around Cairns area now, just leaving their grass a little bit longer so that it seeds and seeding it with other sort of flowering plants that provide the food for those beneficial insects. There's some great work where people have actually put some strips of beneficial insect attracting shrubs in their orchards. And I've even seen this work in hydroponics. One of the posts on my website, I was dragged when I was down in northern New South Wales by a friend. He said, "You've got to come and see this hydroponic grow." And I said, "You know, Paul, what have I, you know, like, what have I got in common with a hydroponic grow?" Because I'm sort of thinking hydroponic growers, you know, you can't be, in a way, less ecological than that. And I went there, and these guys are planting around their shelters. They're planting mixed plantings of shrubs and things to attract beneficial insects. They're also putting in sacrificial crops as well, to a whole mixture and some organic sprays. But they've gone from where they were spraying broad spectrum, pretty nasty chemicals twice a week, to now just every so often spraying with. So, and you can look at it, you can look at holistic grazing. I'm sure a lot of the pastoralists on the Cape will be aware of sort of holistic grazing and Alan Savory. I mean, that's a way of bringing in ecological practices. So it's about, so it's also about, for example, like seeing our soil as our nutrient recycling system. Nearly all our soils are degraded, and so if we can improve the health of our soil, then we get the benefits of those healthy soil. And we've got examples like the, I met just recently a guy called Gabe Brown from North Dakota. He doesn't cultivate anymore. So we'll hear that the sort of latest, and I'm just going to be a little bit opinionated here, but we hear that the sort of the latest is this precision agriculture, where they're using sort of tractors with very expensive GPSs to exactly pinpoint the tracks that they're taking across the, so they go the same track every time to reduce soil compaction. And this is sort of presented as high technology, as advanced technology. But then we have somebody like Gabe Brown and other broadacre croppers around the world who have been working on improving the health of their soil. So they actually leave the creation of good soil structure to the experts, their soil organisms. Mm. And they don't even need to take the tractors out of the sheds anymore.
That's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah. And I mean, a lot of what I've known of you over the last few years, there's always interesting new people coming along to your place, or that you're meeting up with, or that you're going somewhere to see and learn from. And we're quite lucky for you to be bringing that knowledge back here to Hilltop Farm and learning from nature.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, so often or in the past, being more sustainable has been something that is it's almost like a burden. It's a something extra that we have to do. And yet when we start, in a way, bridging the gap between how our food growing systems work, which are in effect ecosystems, and natural ecosystems work, we don't just gain in terms of sustainability. They also become easier to manage. And they become, you reduce, I run a course on improving the profitability of your horticultural enterprise. And one of the main parts of it is about how we can, people, growers, can significantly reduce their input costs by improving the ecological functionings in their properties. And I mean, I'm experiencing it on the farm here. So, I mean, I've had to put the hard work in to get things to change the system, but now it's becoming more self-maintaining. I don't have to mulch. I grow a living mulch. So I grow mulch right where I need it, and it works for me 24/7.
How do you grow mulch?
So what I do is I create a mixture of ground cover species. So legumes, obviously, the ones that bring the nitrogen from the air, but also looking at food plants as well, and food plants for my chickens. And they grow and cover the ground. And when they die, they drop, or when they die, they die, you know, the leaves are dropping all the time. So it becomes self-mulching. And I'm developing a toolkit so that people can do this as well.
So it's quite lovely sitting here in your kitchen, around your kitchen table, and looking out the window, and out the back window there I can see passion fruit vines and banana trees, and looking out the side here I can see some more banana trees out there. I think, is that grapes directly out the front?
Yes.
Off the veranda. And we've got the rear end of a beautiful looking cow.
Mowing the lawn. he's doing a bit of a patchy job, but it will save me some work anyway.
So tell us about your cattle that you have here.
So the cattle, I mean, I eat. They're for home consumption. I don't sell them. But they're also, for me, a land management tool. I practice holistic grazing. And what that is basically it's mimicking the way that grazing animals and browsing animals moved through the landscape in an evolutionary in the past. And so if anybody's seen those sort of wonderful shots of Serengeti National Park in Africa, and you see those mixed mobs of grazing and browsing animals, and you'd see that they're feeding in very tight mobs because they're worried about being eaten. So they feed in tight mobs, they shit in tight mobs, and they move through the landscape really quickly. And the technique was developed by a guy called Alan Savory, who's a South African. And he came across it because when they removed domestic animals from an area, I think it was part of testy fly control, they thought the country would come back, and it didn't. And then he started looking at what's happening. And so it's not sort of rotational grazing. It's actually you adjust your paddock size according to your herd size. And you base that on sort of what an animal would eat per day. And so you move them. In bigger herds, they might be moving them two or three times a day. So I just use electric fencing. And it's something I know some of the larger pastoral holdings are experimenting with, and they're just using single-strand electric fences and using the trees as posts. And I've got Brachia decumbens. It's an tropical African grass that co-evolved with grazing animals in those conditions. And it's already, I'm noticing the difference. It's the soil's getting better and the pasture's getting better. And the big challenge I've had is because I've got a small herd is making sure that I've got enough shade for them. And so I've put two alley plantings across my western sloping paddock, and the trees are now sort of starting to come up on that. So I can put it in the system more sort of thoroughly. So it's fun, you know, that it's fun working with cattle like that because they loved being moved.
Mm. How big is this property?
So it's 10 hectares, but I've got a little bit more because I got under the power lines.
So it's not a large property by any scale. However, there's so many different things that you have growing here and living here. You've got chickens and geese and lots and lots of different edible plants. Could you talk us through some of the things that you have here and how they all work together to create a system here?
I suppose one of the things that I've come to realise is we, in a way, we need more momentum, more biological momentum in our food, in our farms and our gardens. And that means so more stuff growing so that we have more biomass, more biological mass, more organic matter going on our soil. And we know more organic matter in our soil means more water holding capacity, more nutrient holding capacity, better nutrient recycling. You know, it's a win-win situation. And I think that's sort of, in a way, the approach I've had here. We've got two choices with doing that. Nearly all cases we're looking at degraded, we're taking over degraded land. And when I'm talking to people, you know, I would say to them, look, if you're buying a property, everybody always goes and gets a building surveyor to look at the house and check it hasn't got termites and all that sort of stuff, and maybe use it as a leverage to sort of reduce the price if there's a problem. But one of the things I say is always go out and to get a soil test done, because in nearly all situations, the soil has been degraded. So we have to bring those, the health of those, the sort of key, our key natural resources up. And I think we all recognize that. But do we do it in a way that, let's say we improve the health of our soil, but in order to be able to maintain it, we keep on having to add mulch or add compost or add fertilizer? Or can we do it in a way that it becomes self-maintaining? And that's really what I'm doing here. So I had an orchard, and I just had the standard horticultural spacings between the trees. And I've got rid of all of this African grass, which has saved me a huge amount of work. And recently I've done some soil tests, and we're starting to pick up in those areas where we've gone from grasslands, basically, to mixed ground cover, mixed living mulch species. We've got the biology is building up in the soil. So that the fertility of the soil, and it's just so much easier to dig. And it's about creating sort of well-designed layers of vegetation. So I've got ground covers that I can harvest, like, you know, pumpkins and sweet potatoes. I've got a shrub layer that's albica, it's cassava. I've interplanted the fruit trees with pawpaws and bananas. Pigeon peas, which is another legume. I mean, you can harvest those, but it's a lot of work to get few seeds, and then my fruit trees are in there. So the approach is, I suppose, very different from one end of the spectrum. We have monocultures where we're continuously having to really take the role and the burden that the ecosystem would take if we can work to develop our systems to be more. And in here we've got, you know, the landscape here is forest. Going back to, you know, I mentioned earlier about Gabe Brown in North Dakota, he's mimicking, he has set out in the last 20 years to mimic the rangeland ecosystems that he has. Mm. So he has huge areas with grazing and he also has cropping, but he aims to have plants growing in his fields, mixed broadleaf plants. He grows daikon radish. I don't know if anybody knows daikon radish, huge long white roots they had. Mm. And he grows them specifically to break the plow pan in the soil. He chooses cover crops underneath his grain crops that have different root architecture. And so he's not just thinking about the architecture above, but also below. And he's sort of saying, this is what would happen in the rangelands, is that they wouldn't just be corn. There would be a whole mixture of different plants growing in it. And his holistic grazing, which is mimicking what the buffalo had. And, you know, you can look at sort of other examples. There's an amazing example in northern Scotland of a family. They've just, I can't remember the exact size of it, but it sounds like it's just a normal garden size. And they've put in a forest of food there, which is the native, the way the architecture of the vegetation would have naturally been. But they've brought in food trees from all parts of the world, which is wonderful, where we're at, you know, we've got that opportunity. And they feed their whole family. They run all sorts of courses just off this small block with the amount of food that they grow.
So with your place, how many people do you feed? What happens with your produce here?
I used to sell more than I do. I mean, this is one of the, to be honest, Linda, one of the challenges, that if I was adjacent to Cairns or another sort of major metropolitan area, I used to, for example, I used to live in northern New South Wales and I used to sell produce through the markets there. To be honest, in Cooktown, it's really hard. Unless you want to put in 2,000 bananas, I've got 250, but if you put in 2,500 bananas, you could sell down to the main markets in Brisbane and Sydney. And I just didn't want to go that way. So I spent a year selling at the local markets, and then with a group of friends, we set up a social enterprise, Cooktown Food Connect. But when I looked at how much I was earning, it was equivalent to $5 an hour. Mm. And we Cooktown Food Connect, we set it up really well. We had it online. We were selling stuff for the same price as the supermarket. Mm. This was organic produce.
Yeah.
We bought in extra stuff. We even had a stall outside the post office. And it's not unique. I've spoken to other people who are outside these areas. And to be honest, the take-home message that I've got is you can market on health, you can market on, you know, sort of pesticide-free, you can market on taste. And unfortunately, a lot of people, maybe it's just the time, all the time that they've got is just to go to the supermarket. Mm. And so when you've only got a small community, you've only got a small community who are not doing that. Mm. So I sell to my yoga group. Mm-hmm. I swap produce for my editor for the stuff I do for my business. I swap produce for, and I swap among friends and stuff like that. And also the poultry. And that's my long-term goal. I'm not rushing with that, but basically I'm developing an integrated poultry system so that all of this stuff that you're seeing here can feed me and I can sell, but it's also food for the poultry. Mm. And I suppose the business case for that is that we know that freight prices are going to go up with peak oil. We know that grain prices are going up and down as weather conditions change, and that the most egg producers are reliant on grain for their feed. So what I am developing is a system whereby the chooks can get nearly all of their food off the property here, and so that I think it's something like 4/5 of the profit for commercial growers goes on food. So I can reduce that right down, so the risk is lower, You know, maybe the chooks won't produce as high as rate as the, you know, the really industrial level, but I don't need to because I won't have that pressure of the farm. And the other thing that happens is when you start, so the chickens move through the system, they'll follow the cattle, so they'll reduce the number of buffalo fly. And you know, I talked about the living mulch, and I talked about how can we make our system so there's more self-maintaining, so mulching, composting, fertilizing. Well, I go out now into the orchard, and it's self-mulching, mm-hmm. and the chooks are in there busy scratching and shitting.
Yeah.
So they're making compost for me, yes. right where I need it.
Yes, yes, perfect. So, Wendy, thank you for today. We might just have a wrap up with a bit of your thoughts on the future for Cape York with land management and natural resource management. And what do you see as some of the challenges for the Cape? And where do you see a sustainable Cape York and livelihoods for people who live here? How do you see that happening into the future?
Great question. And, I mean, it's always been challenging for people on Cape York, traditional people and pastoralists, because of the low soil fertility. We might get a better rainfall than, say, Western Queensland. But with climate change, it's going to become hotter and potentially drier, I think, away from the coast as well. I mean, who knows? If the world is a complex ecosystem, so we can only go on CSIRO's predictions. I just think the more that we can look to, you know, see natural ecosystems as our models of best practice, not to copy, but to bring out the architecture, you know, the growth forms that they have. And I suppose holistic grazing is an example of that, with your grassland, sort of open grassland savanna systems. And where you've got other areas, how can we sort of use those areas, maybe produce food, but that doesn't sort of involve tilling the land, but maybe supplementary planting. I mean, I was been working with a project that down Archer's Point with...
Yukabaja,
thank you. Sorry, pronunciation. You know, they wanted to do some... They wanted a bush food orchard. And they were looking at putting the standard rows in and having a water tank. And I said, you know, that's going to be a lot of work. You know, setting it up, maintaining it, mowing the grass, whippersnipping the grass until the trees are up. And at the same time, they were talking about that they'd like to regenerate their riparian, their creek bank, vegetation, because they've got huge areas of grade grass and then the creek line. And so what they're trying to get funding for is a project where they were going to be supplementary planting in these degraded riparian areas with high value bush food trees that grow well in those conditions. And that's really important, they grow well in those conditions. And that way they can get a resource off it. The creek bank gets revegetated, and it's not in a way that relies on, you know, just government grants. So it'd be nice to get some funding to get them started. But after that, it becomes something that they get some produce off to sell or for, you know, the community to eat. Yeah, it's a sort of win-win situation. So I think... You know, that great saying, we're only limited by our imagination. And but to think, yeah, let's start thinking differently about what we're doing. And it's exciting.
It is. It absolutely is. It's a great time to be living and working on the Cape, I think.
Yes, most certainly.
Well, thank you, Wendy. The rain's starting to come down a little bit heavier now, so we might wrap up for the day and leave you to whatever else you've got to do out on the farm.
Thanks. It's been lovely talking to you, Linda.
Thanks, Wendy.
Dr. Wendy Seabrook at Hilltop Farm near Cooktown, Cape York. Search online for Hilltop Farm or learningfromnature.com.au. Next time on My Cape York Life.
And I've lived here at Shipton Flat all my life. I'm the third generation of us here, actually. And we're sitting on the bank of Parrot Creek, which is a tributary of the Annan River.
we meet cattle farmer, renowned, award-winning and entirely self-taught naturalist Lewis Roberts. His family has lived on Shipton's flat on the South East Cape for more than 100 years.
Yeah, originally it was a mining area. Our grandparents came here mining tin, and about when the last war was on, the tin had sort of petered out, so it became solely a cattle property then.
My Cape York Life is brought to you by Cape York Natural Resource Management, with support from South Cape York Catchments and the Australian Government's National Land Care Program. You can find us at Cape York Land Manager, or you can download us from your favourite podcast app. Also, find us on Facebook and Twitter, and tell your friends about My Cape York Life. I'm Lyndall Scoble, and I'll see you next time on My Cape York Life.